The following is a 1250 WTMA special presentation.
The History of TMA.
Hi, this is John Quincy, welcoming you to another special hour on 1250 WTMA. As we continue to look back at the rich heritage of Charleston's second oldest commercial radio station, and the only AM radio station with its original call letters. It's the radio station you're listening to right now, 1250 WTMA.
TMA, the station that swings in Charleston.
In the last hour of the history of TMA, we looked at the station's beginnings from WTMA's sign-on in June of 1939 through the 1940s. This hour, we're going to move up a decade as we hear from some of the folks who worked here in the 50s, including one of the most popular morning men in TMA's history, Jack Gale.
Hi, everybody. Jack Gale welcoming you once again into the Bud Room, brought to you by Budweiser Beer.
When exactly were you at WTMA?
I would have to say, John, if I remember, it's probably 55, 56, 57. I know I left in 57 to go to Baltimore, and I assume that it was probably about 55, sometime in 55, that I went there.
Was WTMA your first radio job?
Oh, no. Goodness gracious. I started way back in 1944. I was in Cleveland, and I had worked in Cumberland, Maryland in 1948 and then got out of radio because I got married, couldn't make any money, and got in the insurance business. And then in 1950, they called me from WTBO and said somebody named Chuck Smith had bought that station and wanted to talk to me, had heard some stuff that when I was there 2 years before. So I called him and said, you know, I just couldn't go on the radio. I couldn't make any money, and I had twins, and there was none. And he said, well, drive over and talk to us. I was in Baltimore. And I went over there, and I think they offered me probably like $50 a week and you know, to go back there. And I said, I was making like 100 and some in the insurance business, and I would love to do it because I love radio, but I couldn't do it. So I said no, and I went back downstairs. They were over a bank building, and my wife said, you know, you really need to take it. I said, we can't get along. She said, well, we'll have to get along. Somebody will hear you someday. And I said, well, let me put it to you this way. If New York is the head and Los Angeles is the feet, you can imagine where Cumberland is. So I said, I don't think so. So anyway, she said, you know, go back up there and take. So I went back up, and I said, if you give me $52.50, I'll take it. So I did. And eventually, it took me a long, long time to get into a larger city, and I finally got into Cleveland. I was in Cleveland about 3 years, and Chuck Smith called me and said he had bought a station in Charleston, South Carolina, and offered me the program director's job. And I just had a hunch because I knew him and I knew who he was bringing in as a sales guy. We had worked together, and I just had a hunch, and I said, I'll be there. And people said, you know, you are leaving Cleveland to go to South Carolina? Are you crazy? But it was a great move, and that were three of the greatest years. I've really had a lot of fun there, and it was terrific. I really enjoyed myself, and Chuck was a great guy, and we just had a great staff and had an awful lot of fun, and the audience was tremendous. The audience was terrific. I just have great memories of that.
Now, you were morning man, and you say you were program director, too?
Yeah. He offered me program director's job, and sometimes it wasn't the greatest thing because it was my first job in management. Yeah, I was morning in PD, and we had a young fellow there who had carried my records at Record Hops in Cleveland, and I brought him in and put him on afternoon drive. His name was Dick Drury, and I found out that he had taken an audition somewhere else. So I told him, I said, did you take an audition over there? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, we don't want that here. If you're dissatisfied, you need to get out now. And I fired, and I went down to Chuck Smith, and I was so proud of myself. And I said, this was about 11 o'clock in the morning. And I said, I just fired Dick Drury because he took an audition at another station. And Chuck says, well, that's fine. Who's going to work that shift? And I said, well, I said, you know, we'll put, you know, whoever in there. And he said, no, we can't do that because they're labor and they'll get overtime. You're management, so you don't get any overtime, so you'll have to work that shift. I said, wait a minute, I work the morning. He says, yeah, I know that. He said, but you need to learn when you fire somebody, you have to fire them at your convenience, not just on a whim. So he says, so until you get somebody else in there, you'll have to cover that because we can't pay overtime.
Oh, you had some stupid tax you paid.
Quick learn. It was a quick learn. And Dick went on later to become a big-time program director in Pittsburgh. He went on and did real well.
Now, WTMA was a top 40 radio station when you got here?
John, we didn't have top 40 then. We played, you know, Bing Crosby and Perry Como and those kind of records. It was just what we called nice popular music is what it was. I guess it was Patti Page back in those days and things like that. Nobody was playing, you know, what we call rock and roll. I did started a program called The Hound Dog on Friday or Saturday night and played that, but nobody else had ever played that kind of music. music there.
So tell me about the Hound Dog Show.
When I was in Cleveland, there was a guy that I'm sure you heard the name Alan Freed. I heard him playing this kind of music, Fats Domino and the Drifters, and I'd never heard that kind of music before because nobody had played it in those days. When I came to Charleston, I just started a show called The Hound Dog, and I had the sound effects of a dog howling, and the dog would howl, and I'd talk to the records. If they would sing a question, I would answer it and keep the mic on the whole time and scream, and had a beat. It was a rhythm beat. When the record stopped, this rhythm beat would take on, and I would talk in rhyme to the rhythm beat, and we had requests. People would send in cards, and I'd type them all up, and I'd read like 30, 40 names at rapid fire in between that. It was one of these shows where you could get drunk listening to it. Later on, it was in four cities when I went to Baltimore, but it really took off there. It was a terrific show, and I opened a record store called the Hound Dog Record Shop, and we sold Fats Domino, Joe Turner, those kind of people, Muddy Waters, Wilson Pickett. We sold those records in that store. It was on King Street.
So that's probably why you did the show, to make it profitable with the record store, because not too many morning guys would volunteer to come back and do a show late on Friday night.
Yeah, right, and all, including Dick's show. From 4 to 8, until we hired a fellow named Steve Carroll. And I didn't even audition him. I put an ad in the trade papers, a broadcasting magazine, and the first guy that called me about the ad, I said, "You're hired." I didn't want to work 4 to 8, but he worked out very well. And we're still friends today. He lives about 40 miles from me.
Tell me about some of the other things you did at WTMA besides the morning show and the Hound Dog Show. You had some other features too as well, right?
Well, yeah, I did. I did a lot of commercials, but there's another thing that used to be a pier. I don't know if it's still there in Folly Beach, called the Folly Beach Pier. Is that still around?
They have rebuilt it. It burned down and they rebuilt it.
I rented that pier for the summer, and we brought in all the big artists. I was in there with a partnership with a fellow named Harry Janaris. He may still be around, at an advertising agency there. We did pretty well at that pier. I had that for the whole season. We brought in, you know, people like Pat Boone and Connie Francis and those people. Of course, she wasn't as big a star then as she is now, but Pat Boone was, and we brought in a lot of the kind of music we played then were Gogie Grant, Jerry Vale, you know, that's what we were playing. I guess you'd call it sort of square music today, but that's what was on. But I played a lot of novelty stuff. I played a lot of Spike Jones and these kind of records, off the beaten track. And I did a lot of voices, had a lot of characters, had a soap opera there, and there was a fella that wrote a column for the newspaper. It was called the News Courier then, and I think he used the name of the Two Rivers. I think he called
Ashley himself. Cooper, yes.
Ashley Cooper, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I used to call him Cooper Ashley, and we had a big feud, and it benefited me because when I first came there, I started blasting his column, and then he started writing about me in the column, so we had a running feud going at that time. I just loved it. It mattered not when I worked. You know, work at night, daytime, it didn't make any difference. But I learned a lot there. I learned a lot from Chuck Smith, and I think he's passed on, but I learned a lot from him. And I worked over at Channel 2 for a while, not on staff, but there was a furniture store there named J.O. Goldberg. The son was Sonny Goldberg. I guess people may still remember him. And we started a commercial where he would come in and sing two lines of one of the top songs of the day. And, of course, he couldn't sing, and he would sing worse than he could anyway. And he would sing two lines of this song, and it was terrible. And then he would say, my father, J.L. Goldberg, says I better stop wasting his money singing and start telling you about our furniture. And he would go on with that, and it became a very, very big thing. People would call up and say, get that guy off the air. He is horrible. He has no business singing. And they would walk into the store, and he would end a commercial saying, come in and see me at our furniture store, and I'll sing a song for you. And we wrote a song called Serenade of the King Street Singer, and we had sheet music printed up, 1,000 of them, and I think he gave almost everyone away in about 4 days. I guess most of the pianos in the homes in that area all had the music of the King Street Singer on there. People were playing it and singing it. It was really funny. And he would come out to some record ops with me and actually try to sing, and they'd boo him off, but it was all a commercial.
Great for business, I bet.
Oh, yeah, it was terrific. It really was. But people used to call up and really scream. I mean, you know, if you play it straight, they go along with you, and a lot of them thought it was for real, that he was really trying to sing. And whatever the number one or number two song was those days, that's what he would try to sing, and it was really horrible. One of the memories I had was he used to travel with the Cooper River High School or North Charleston High School, I forget what it was, called the Blue Devils, and we'd go to Conway and Monk's Corner and all these different areas, and one time we went to Somerville to play Somerville. I was out there. We used to just have like a bingo table and set up right at the field the remote equipment, and I was doing the first quarter in a thunderstorm. Rain, you couldn't see anything. It was all mud and slosh, and one of the guys from the station came out after the first quarter and said, you're not on the air. And I said, when did we go off? He said, you never were on. And did the whole first quarter into a dead microphone in the rain. So you learn those things, you know.
Oh, yeah. Always make sure you're on the air before you start talking.
Right. But I just had a ball in Charleston. I really did. I guess, you know, it was a development period for me. I really developed sort of a style there, and that followed me through. But that was never my first radio job. Boy, I started in Danville, Virginia, and then went to Salisbury, Maryland, Fairmont, West Virginia. You know, when I left TMA, well, I was in Cleveland before that, but when I left TMA, I went to Baltimore, and I was there about 6 or 7 years doing a morning show there.
We find the Rodenberg boys, Dolph and Adolph, out duck hunting. Now, they don't know we're listening in on their conversation, but in the bag there, in the knapsack on the back of Dolph's back, we have a hidden microphone. Let's tune in and hear what the Rodenberg boys, Dolph and Adolph, are talking about right now.
What's that, Adolph? What'd you say?
I said that, I ain't seen the kitchen nothing here now. You got that shotgun ready there, Dolph?
Yeah, it's all set, Adolph.
Well, look, here they come. Let them have it, boy. Hit 'em. Ain't hitting nothing, Dolph.
I'm trying, Adolph. Come on, get up.
You got him, I think. Yeah. All right, Dolph. You got him. Dolph, all right. Dolph, you got him.
I got him.
Yeah, there he come. Right down to it there. Yeah, you got him, boy.
Boy, he's really a nice one, ain't he?
Yeah, he sure is, Dolph. He really, really nabbed him there. You know, I just went back to the field house there and I called up the store.
You called up the Rodenberg store? What for, Adolph?
Well, I called him up to tell him to put some of that Blue Star frozen beef and turkey and chicken pies on sale, 3 for $59.
Yeah, that's a good idea, Adolph. Boy, oh boy, that's a good idea. Blue Star frozen beef, turkey, and chicken pies at the Rodenberg store today, 3 for $0.25.
That's what I'm going to do, Dolph.
That's a good idea, Adolph.
Yeah, it is that. That's what I'm going to do. Cross and Blackwell frozen broccoli spears.
I got another one there. I got another one of them.
You did. Well, I'm heading back to the store. Come on, let's go.
Yeah, we got enough. I'll just steal a couple more.
Blue Star frozen beef, turkey, and chicken pies, 3 for $59. And Cross Blackwell frozen broccoli spears, 2 packages for $0.25. That's what we're selling today at Rodenberg. Right, Dolph?
What's that, Adolph? I got another one.
Come on, now let's get going back to the store.
More with Jack Gale on the way on the History of TMA.
There's more History of TMA with John Quincy coming up straight ahead on 1250 WTMA.
Mighty TMA.
Now, the history of TMA continues on 1250 WTMA. Once again, John Quincy.
We return to our look back at the history of 1250 WTMA, Charleston's second oldest radio station, as we continue our conversation with TMA's mid-50s morning personality, Jack Gale. Can you tell us a little bit about the programming throughout the day? You started it off, and then who else did you have there during your time?
Yeah, I started off, and there was a fella on the air named Bill Walton. I don't know where he is today. We had a fella named Jerry Spinn, who later went to Cleveland, became a PD, and he's passed on. Bob Calvert was there. He went to Norfolk and became a program director, and he's long gone. Buddy Charles is out in California, retired. He was a youngster, had a teenage show. There was a fella named Bob Truer that did the news. I still remember that. And we had Steve Carroll, who right now lives about 40 miles from me. Bill Evenson did the news there and later went to NBC and Mutual. So we had a lot of great talent there. I mean, those guys all went on to do big things. One funny experience, we were in the Dock Street Theater then, which I think is the oldest theater in the country, so they told me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a hot day. We didn't have air conditioning, by the way. And it was a hot day, and I was looking out of the window, second floor, the Dock Street Theater on Church Street. I was just opening the window to get some air, and there was a guy down there taking pictures. So he waved to me, and I waved to him. And about 5 months later, I'm at a drugstore down at the corner, and I'm going through some picture postcards in the rack, and here's a picture of the Dock Street Theater and me waving out of the window. The guy was a postcard photographer. I still have that card. Made me very famous, you know.
Probably didn't make you very rich, though.
No. got no royalties, got no nothing, you know. But it was just a great time, and the audience was just amazing. I used to take calls on the air. It was really terrific. And Bill Evenson was the news guy in the morning, and we had a feud going all the time. And we have been friends, I guess, 50 years since then. He's out in California, retired. He's doing some movies and some directing and some movie writing. And we talk probably once a week. But I made a lot of great friends down there. And TMA was just a huge number one at that time. I was starting to tell you that I was over at Channel 2. Sonny Goldberg at J.M. Goldberg, they bought the late movie. And I did the commercials for the in between the films. We had a late movie that went on like 11 o'clock.
Did you have to do those live?
Oh, yeah, live. We had no teleprompters or anything in those days. There were not even cards. You know, you just tried to remember what you were saying and talked about the furniture. And, of course, they didn't deliver any furniture to the set, so we just had to say, you know, that we had living rooms. And I mean, there were no living rooms in the studio, so we just had living room sets, dining room sets. They did have a refrigerator, and they had a little fella out there who worked at the TV station. He was probably under 5 feet tall. And I took all the shelves out of the refrigerator and put him in there. He got in there and crouched down, and I held the door, just a little bit of air for him to breathe. The refrigerator looked closed, and I said, folks, you can put anything in these huge refrigerators, and opened the door. He stepped out and said, hi, folks, and walked off and totally ignored him, didn't he, like he wasn't even there, you know. And we did funny commercials. The phone would ring in the middle of the commercial, and I would pick it up, and I would say, no, Sonny, we don't take requests, and hung up, you know. So I just love to do off-the-wall stuff like that. I just like to run a hi-ho, folks, come to the fair type radio station.
The story of Charleston and its surroundings. The story that asks the question, will the rich, handsome Yankee gentleman, Rodney New York, marry Mary Lou Cumby and build a parking lot on her father, Daddy Cumby's plantation? Our story opens today. Against Daddy Cumby's wishes, Mary Lou Cumby is secretly meeting with that newfangled Yankee gentleman, Rodney New York, out beneath one of the oak trees in the evening on the Cumby plantation. Listen.
Rodney, I think y'all just the sweetest man I ever did see.
Ah, Mary Lou Cumby, I am a real fine gentleman, ain't I?
Rodney, I believe that y'all about one of the nicest men ever to come here on Daddy Cumby's plantation. I really believe that. Well, Rodney, I hate to say it.
Go on, tell me, you like my good looks and all my money up there in the northern city of New York, and you like me to come down here and marry you, is that it? But I wouldn't live in a dump like this.
Now, wait a minute, Rodney. What are y'all calling a dump?
This place around here, nothing but grass and rivers and trees and horses and stables and stuff like that. It ain't modern. It ain't nothing. You ever been in that city of Charleston? They got plaster falling all over the pavements and everything. Well, I saw one of them churches there with the steeple halfway busted down. I'm afraid to walk on that side of the street. This place is for the birds. If you marry me, Mary Lou Cumby, Southern Belle, you'll have to come up to New York and live in civilization.
Why, Rodney, New York, you're talking about the area that I love, the area that Daddy Cumby raised me in down here in the old Southland. Why, you're talking about some of the most beautiful buildings and right here, the lovely grass and trees and everything there. What's that I hear in the background? I hear a horse hoof coming up there.
That looks like that mean old man, that mean old southern gentleman, Daddy Cumby, my daddy.
Here he comes. You better hide behind the tree, Rodney New York. Here's Daddy Cumby coming now. Hello, Daddy Cumby.
Hello there, Charles. Whoa, boy, whoa. Charles, what are you doing out here underneath the tree of Daddy Cumby's plantation on this nice southern night by yourself?
I'm just looking at the southern moon, Daddy Cumby. I'll be in a wee bit.
All right, Charles. I want you to come in the house real quickly so we can have a mint julep together before we retire here on the plantation.
All right, Daddy Cumby. I'll be in a moment. You go on along inside.
Well, the old geezer's gone, ain't it?
Don't talk about my Daddy Cumby that way. And furthermore, I'm not sure I like your Yankee talk at all.
I tell you, if you marry me, we'll inherit this whole plantation when Daddy Cumby dies, Mary Lou.
Yes, I know that, and I'm going to keep it just as beautiful now, Rodney, as it ever was, with the rippling streams and the oak trees.
Oh, let's tear it down and build a parking lot on this plantation.
Rodney, New York, I don't know if I ever want to see you again.
Well, looks like a fit of temper coming there between beautiful Mary Lou Cumbie, daughter of Daddy Cumbie out on the Cumbie Plantation, and that handsome Yankee, Rodney New York. What will happen tomorrow? Be sure to be with us tomorrow for another heart-throbbing southern chapter of Southland, a story of Charleston and its surroundings. The story that asks the question, will Rodney New York, the rich, handsome Yankee gentleman, marry Mary Lou Cumbie and build a parking lot on Daddy Cumbie's plantation? Until tomorrow, y'all, this is Pinckney Ravnell saying, enjoyed it, yeah?
I think the first really major job I had outside of Cleveland was WTMA, because when we went down there, TMA was not much of a power. In wattage it was, but it didn't really have the listeners. It didn't really have that much of a power. There was a fella named Hank Guzik that I worked at in Cumberland, and he was a kind of salesman that just, he sold me great. And when Chuck Smith called me, I was in Cleveland, and he said, do you know where Charleston, South Carolina is? And I said, not really. And he said, blah, blah, and he offered me this job. And I said, you know, I said, I've got a funny feeling. I said, where's Hank Guzik? And he says, he's out running a station in California. I said, well, if you can get Hank, I said, I'll come down. We didn't even talk salary. And he said, that's a funny thing, because I just got off the phone with Hank, and he said, if you can get Jack, I'll come there.
Wow.
So we went there together, and we just had a great, great time. It was, I guess, 3-4 great years for me.
Do you remember much about your competition in Charleston, the other stations on the air?
I know some personalities that were there at the time, but I don't remember who was on in the morning. Jay Mullen was on one of the other stations there, and it was a Ken Kleiss. I think a name Ken Kleiss comes to mind. And I don't remember, too, but there was a fellow on TV that Tony Glenn was there. Gosh, I don't remember too many of the other people at the other stations, because I never... George Wilson was on a station called WOKE,
mm-hmm.
and he later went to TMA, I think, in the late 50s, early 60s, and went on to become one of the big PDs out in L.A. I know Drayton Hastie had Channel 2 at the time.
Yeah, WCSC was one of the stations, WCSC
right,
Radio.
Right, they were the CBS station.
And
I think Jay Mullen was over there, but I think Jay was at TMA maybe before I came there also.
And WQSN, I think, was 1450.
QSN, right, and the TV station was USN.
Yes.
Channel 2.
Yes.
Yeah, QSN, right, correct. And I think there was a another station there. Could it be PAL?
Yes, it could be.
Okay, I remember that.
Yep, yep,
of course,
yep.
Now, you got to remember, John, this was way before FM.
You're doing pretty good there.
Well, but you see, the competition wasn't like it is today. Today, you know, you've got not only the FM stations and the AM stations all battling, and I figure you've got 25, 30 stations in that area. Plus, you've got TV, and then you've got computers, you've got cable, television. You know, there's so much for people to do and watch now that I think it's a lot tougher now to do anything than it was in those days. Those days, they had 4 radio stations to listen to. That was it. The entertainment hours are just split up now. I mean, it's very tough. Before, people used to just live by the radio. To me, radio now is mostly in cars, I would think, and I don't know if there's any surveys for cars, so I don't really believe much of these Arbitron ratings, because I don't know. I don't ever turn the radio on at home. I listen to it in the car, but not at home.
Do you remember much about the WTMA studios and offices in detail, or has it been so long ago? What was the control room like?
Yeah, well, I remember Chuck Smith's office was downstairs, and they had the bookkeeping office downstairs, but upstairs was the stairway, and we had the studio upstairs without any air conditioning, and a little newsroom, and a bathroom, and I guess probably a table to sit down and have a Coke or a sandwich or something. That was about it.
Not even a production studio?
I don't think so. I think we used the newsroom for production.
Oh, okay.
We must have had a production studio, because we did do taping, but we had these great big reel-to-reel Ampex tapes and, of course, the 16-inch turntables that we played transcriptions on, because if the commercials came in, the national accounts, you know, like Stand Back or Headache Powder or something, they were on these 16-inch transcriptions.
Wow.
We had these huge tone arms. They were about a foot and a half long to play these big transcriptions. And, of course, these were 78 records. You have to remember that. They were no 45s at that time.
So this is long before the advent of tape cartridges.
Oh, yeah. We just had reel-to-reel tape, and we had the Magna Quarter little brown suitcase-type tape machines. And some of the tapes were like 3-inch reels, and you'd have to spin them and cue them to get the commercial ready to go. Totally different than it was today. Everything was manual. There were no carts. This is way before 8-tracks, even. And we had the big RCA boom microphones and the old Gates boards, and you probably remember those. I still do radio commercials every day, and I do a couple that are on the air there in Charleston, but I don't want to give anybody free commercials. And, you know, so it's, I guess that keeps me in the business, you know. And I had some wonderful experiences in Nashville. I never really lived there. I had an apartment there. We had a record company. We did the TV albums. You see them on TV, 20 great hits of, call 1-800, Visa, MasterCard, not sold in stores. We did Willie and Waylon and Tanya Tucker and these kind of people. When I was in Baltimore, I happened to pick up a kid who was 15 years old named Johnny Cymbal. And we had a million seller in 63 called Mr. Bassman. It was the first record, had the bomb, bomb, bomb in it, that kind of stuff. So we were pretty lucky there, and had a hit 10 years before that in Cleveland called Oh Happy Day, which was a big record for us. Later came out and was a hit again 10 years later. But then I had three stations of my own over the years. Started out in 1971. I had one in Missouri and sold that and bought one in California. Sold that and bought one in Cocoa Beach, Florida. So yeah, I've been, I guess, the whole gamut, you know.
So besides your radio career on the air, you owned radio stations and got a chance to dabble in the music business.
Yeah, really enjoyed the music business. I sold a lot of masters, cut a lot of doo-wop stuff in Baltimore, and had quite a few things on the charts. And, you know, so it went hand in hand with the radio business. It's all one and the same.
And you're recording commercials today from your home studio.
Yeah, I have what they call an ISDN line. I'm sure you're familiar with that. And I do commercials for agencies across the country. And, you know, it's the same thing. I mean, you can do a commercial with somebody in L.A. the same time on the phone line. Only it doesn't sound like the telephone. It's a special line that works through the phone. But it's Sinatra did an album, I guess, 10 years ago called Duets. Had Tony Bennett, Barbara Streisand, all these people in it. Nobody was in the same studio at the time that they were harmonizing. They did it all on the ISDN line. One guy was in Spain, somebody else was in Miami. So the ISDN line is a pretty big thing for me. I don't have to drive to studios. I just stay home. I've got a soundproof studio here, and it's all digital, and you know, we can do CDs and DATs and whatever, and that's what I do all day.
Budweiser Room came to you over Radio Charleston.
So long, everybody.
Hit it there, Pinky. Let's go down to the audience, see if we can get some comments about the Bud Room there.
And don't you think this is the greatest program on the air?
Yes, I certainly do that. Mr. Gale is tremendous.
He certainly is a wonderful announcer.
Only reason I come to the Bud Room is to see Mr. Gale. He certainly is great.
Our thanks to Jack Gale for his memories of his time in Charleston at 1250 WTMA. Coming up next on the history of TMA, we'll talk to another TMA DJ from the 50s, Steve Carroll.
For more about WTMA's past, surf to WTMAmemories.com for recordings, interviews, pictures, and more. That's WTMAmemories.com. More of the special program, The History of TMA, next on 1250 WTMA.
The History of TMA.
Once again, John Quincy.
This hour on the history of TMA, we're looking back at the 1950s years. Steve Carroll was a popular 1250 DJ during the 50s.
I don't recall exactly when in 55 I got down to your beautiful city, and it was lovely. I really enjoyed it there. Jack hired me. I was working up north and sent a tape down, and it just happened that a guy named Dick Drury, who I really never met, was doing afternoons and had left. And Jack was really in a spin trying to get somebody to come down and do the afternoon. So he heard that tape, gave me a call, and asked me to come down and go to work. I never met him. So I arrived there and took over Drury's slot doing the afternoon. I do recall that early afternoon, I don't know whether it was noon to one or one to two, they were still doing some soaps. And my job was to come in on station breaks from the network, you know, WTMA, NBC, for all of Charlie, you know, et cetera, like that, and on to the next. And I also recall that back then we had no cart machines. Everything was reel to reel on these very large tape decks. And the way you had to work was to cue the commercials up, because they'd have a bunch of them on one reel. And you'd cue them up so that when the break came, or when you were doing your own show and you had a commercial insert, if it wasn't live, if it was taped, you'd have to have that big reel-to-reel job queued up, hit the button, and hope you cued it right. I recall going through that process, and it was really a pain back then. So that was a long time before the technology came along with cart machines and decks and that sort of thing.
So how long were you at WTMA?
I was there most of 55. I recall having a beautiful little carriage house in back of a large home in the area. Jack had started a little record thing called the Hound Dog Record Shop. He used to do a show called Hound Dog late at night on the weekends. And he had this howling dog on a loop tape. And in between records, you know, he'd say, "How do you like that dog?" And the dog would howl. You know, the dog likes that. And he was doing mostly R&B back in then. And so I went into the record shop with him, and we became kind of partners in that. We had a lot of fun doing Sonny Goldberg, the King Street Singer. Just had a good time. He then left to go back. He got a job in Baltimore, which was his dream, because WITH in Baltimore, I think he grew up with that way back when. And I left shortly thereafter and took a job with the television station.
Channel 2, WUSN?
Yeah, I believe that was it. And I wasn't with them long. I was about with them maybe 4 months, maybe five. And I left to return to New York to see what I could do up there. WTMA was great. You know, the old theater up on the second floor. We had a good time. I toured for a week. Louis Armstrong had come down to do a concert or something for the station, and I emceed it. And he and his group were going to do several shows around South Carolina. And so I traveled with them for about 4 or 5 days and just, you know, introduced the show at all of these various concerts. Had a good time doing that. I used to sit up weekend nights with Jack while he did Hound Dog, and sit in the studio and kibitz with him. And we became very close, and we still are.
Now, unfortunately, there are no tapes that remain of WTMA from the 50s. So we can just use our imaginations to kind of figure out what the radio station sounded like in the mid-50s when you and Jack were there.
It was basically top 40 as far as music. Jack did a lot of R&B, but he only did it on that late night show. He sat at the console and he had a ruler, and he used to slam, try and do it. He used to slam the desk, you know, in beat with the music. And while he was doing that, this tape of this Hound Dog was going crazy in the background. He would bring up the pot to fade the tape in and out as he wanted to. And he would come in and say, "Do you like that record, dog?" He used a very raspy, "All right, Hound Dog, do you like that?" You know, that kind of an approach. And he'd turn the pot up and the dog would come in, "Oh, the dog do like that record," you know, that kind of thing. No one knew it was Jack, it was Hound Dog.
Now, this was sort of a transition period for radio, because it was moving away from the largely network programming.
Yeah, they still had network programming on TMA, as I recall, because I used to do station breaks early afternoon. They were running soaps and they were running, you know, network news.
How much of WTMA was network programming during the time that you were there, just roughly, and how much of it was local?
The morning. So I know that 6 to 9 was not network. I'm trying to recall whether he took network news. I know that I did. I took network news, and I took breaks between some of the network soaps.
The studios there, do you remember them being typical of the day, nicer, not quite as nice compared with what you've
seen? No, they were very nice. They were up on the second floor of the theater building, and we had a separate entrance and went up a flight of steps. I remember the control room pretty well, a large console, you know, with a typical control board of that period. And then behind it, I had a swivel chair, and I had to spin around to one side. We had these large racks that held these tape decks that were all reel-to-reel. And I recall there were either three or four of them, two of them mounted in each rack. We did a lot of live commercials back then, which I think were more meaningful than canned stuff, because you could get some personality into them and do a little better sales job, in my opinion. But we enjoyed TMA, and I love the town. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you a very funny story. My wife and I were visiting one of our kids in Asheville, North Carolina, and we came down 26, and instead of turning south to go home on 95, we went into Charleston. And And there's a big Hampton Inn in Charleston now, located, I think it's next to where all the buses come in, the big terminal. And we go to check into that Hampton Inn, and the girl at the desk comes up, you know, and told her we'd like a room. She starts to give us a room, and I said to her, you know, I used to work here years and years ago. And she said, oh, really? I said, where? And I said, WMA. And there was this old black gentleman behind the desk. I guess he was a porter. He was very neatly dressed. He looked to me like he had to be in his late 70s or 80s. And he said, you work WTM? I said, yeah. I said, when? I said, with Jack Gale. I remembers Mr. Gale. I said, yeah, I worked there. He said, what was your name? I said, Steve Cash. He says, I remembers you too. And he turns to this desk clerk and he says, you needs to give Mr. Carroll a beautiful, I remembers him and Mr. Gale. I said, really, do you remember us? Do you remember Sonny Goldberg, the King? Oh, I remembers him, the King Street singer. So I wound up with this gorgeous room. I still love that town. I think the Battery area is beautiful. I love riding through the old streets there. It's just a beautiful city.
Thanks, Steve, for taking part in the history of TMA. This is John Quincy.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock.
It must have been a thrill to be a WTMA DJ during the early years of rock and roll. But can you imagine how exciting it was to be a teenage DJ at the number one station in town in the 50s? Next on the history of TMA, we'll talk to someone who had the pleasure of putting on the WTMA headphones every day, that is, after he finished his classes at high school.
John Quincy returns with more of the history of TMA next.
You're here with 1250. Get the word from the swing in 3 on TMA Day.
You're listening to the history of TMA. With more, here's Charleston radio historian John Quincy.
The history of TMA rolls on as we talk to Buddy Charles, a lucky WTMA DJ in the 50s, and quite possibly one of the youngest on-air people in TMA's history. So, Buddy Charles, tell me about coming to Charleston and WTMA.
Being a Navy junior, I moved to Charleston in 1954. As I moved there in September, WTMA had just been purchased by Atlantic Coast Broadcasting, I believe. Chuck Smith was the station manager, and Jack Gale and Steve Carroll and Bill Walton were the on-air personalities in those days. I was 15 and a sophomore at Shikora High School. Sometime in September, WTMA had a dance for all the teenagers in Charleston down at the Fort Sumter Hotel, and I attended the dance, and being a pushy teen, I guess, I got to know not only the three personalities, but Chuck Smith as well. About 2 weeks later, I ran into Chuck Smith at the ball field alongside of Shikora High School, and he was doing kind of a one-man operation, announcer engineer for the National Little League playoffs. He needed someone to pull tags on ball players and monitor gain on the portable mixer he had there. So having met him, I volunteered and he accepted. About 2 weeks later, I was running gain at church remotes. Time went by, and by, oh, I guess Christmas, I'd learned to turn the transmitter on and off. In those days, our studios were located in the Dock Street Theater building, and the transmitter, I guess it's still where it is, across the Ashley River there.
At the very end of Orange Grove Road.
Right. We could broadcast from the transmitter site, but I think we only did that once when we had a real telephone problem. The rest of the time, it was always the Dock Street Theater, which were nice, and actually a nice studio. We had a control room there and just one studio that had a table with three microphones, a piano, and taping was comparatively new. We had two magnacorders sitting on the back rack and some device which enabled us to get them so that we could have 10.5-inch reels so we could record an hour at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I was a senior there at the Citadel, they did put in a new board, and I think by that time they had switched over and they were using quarter-track Mobius loop cartridges.
Oh, tape cartridges, yeah.
Yeah, so we had gone from gouging aluminum to tape cartridges. Anyway, Jack Gale didn't show up one morning after a Christmas party. I turned the transmitter on, started playing music. The telephone rang, and Chuck Smith said, where's Jack? And I said, well, he's not here, Mr. Smith. And he said, well, do you think you can handle it until he gets in? And that was the start of my being an announcer at WTMA. So I spent my sophomore, my junior, and my senior year of high school there. working, and then I went to the Citadel there in Charleston, graduated in 1961, and went on to other things, didn't stay in the radio business, but had a lot of fun those 3 years.
Being a high school kid on the air at such a huge radio station, you probably didn't have any problem getting dates, did you?
Well, I didn't probably have any problem getting them if I had the time to have them. They had me working on the weekends, and I remember one time I was substituting for Jack in the morning. I did an afternoon show, and Bill Walton called in sick, so I was on the air 18 hours one day. And then, of course, we did a program on Saturday evening, also called The Hound Dog. You probably talked to Jack about that. He was known as King Hound Dog, and I referred to myself as Duke of the Dogs. It was kind of like Wolfman Jack used to do, except we used to go, "Hound Dogs, here we go, rocking and rolling with Fats Domino."
I bet that was a hoot to listen to.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had a great time. And, of course, in those days, we used to call ourselves Radio Charleston. This is Radio Charleston, WTMA, WTMA FM. Once in a while, when we got carried away with ourselves, we'd call it Whitma and Whitmafoom. Of course, it was kind of crazy for a 15-year-old to come on and say, "It's Budweiser taste time in Charleston. Time to prove to yourself that those who know buy Bud." Correct Eastern Standard Time, time to buy Bud. It's 9:30.
So you were probably a pretty popular guy in your high school, having a job at WTMA on the weekends and the evenings, huh?
Yes, but it took them a little while to figure it out, because my actual name is Charles Gassett. I was a Navy junior, but my father, being a naval officer, was not too happy about having his son working on a radio station. So we flipped the name around and used my first name as my last name, and my middle name as my first name. So it became Buddy Charles.
Oh, that's neat.
I guess people would probably like to remember the times that we broadcast from Kate's Drive-In. I'm sure that's not in business any longer. Or the patio drive-ins. We had little broadcast booths up at the top of the two drive-ins, and would play records from there. Everybody'd honk their horns and scream and yell and dance in the parking lot. So that was a good time.
And I'm sure when Elvis came to town, you were probably part of that, huh?
Oh, yes. Of course, soon after that, Jack, besides having the Hound Dog radio program, we had a record shop down on King Street. It was called the Hound Dog Record Shop. With the record shop and the radio station, we had entertainers like Pat Boone, Gogie Grant, Eileen Rogers at Folly Beach Pier and at the County Hall. And then later on, we brought in people like Fats Domino, Bo Diddley, and many, many, many others all summer long. I remember one night, there was a guy there, his name was Ted something. Ted and I were pulling an all-night hurricane watch. I was on the board, and Ted was announcing for some reason that evening. And he said, "Winds of 150 miles an hour may hit the South Carolina coast."
Wow.
And I reached over and slipped through the stack of sound effects records we had and found High Velocity Wind and threw it down on the table and then just brought it up very slowly behind him in the background. And he said, "My God, they're here now!" About a minute later, line three, which was the line that the boss always called in on, was flashing. And Chuck Smith, "You guys, this could be serious. Let's not play around up there." But other than that, you know, we had a pretty good time.
How was Chuck Smith to work for?
Well, for me, he was pretty good because, you know, I was a kid, and I guess he looked at me as a kid, even though he gave me a key to the front door, you know. But I think he was pretty hard on Gail and Walton, you know, because he expected TMA to stay on top. I think he probably didn't necessarily put his livelihood that I would show up every day, because, you know, you are a teenager and you don't have perhaps the same kind of responsibility that others would have. But I was there, and I was there many times that other people weren't there.
Do you remember how much you made at WTMA back in the 50s?
God, it was something like $2 an hour.
Hey, that's pretty good for the 50s.
Yeah. Yeah, about $2 an hour.
A lot more than minimum wage.
Yeah, but what he would allow, and I did quite a bit of that, he would allow us to go out and make a deal with like a clothing store or something of that nature and actually throw spots in for the clothing store, which we had kind of put together. So we got free clothes, and we gave the clothing store spots on the shows that we would do, you know. So that was kind of like money under the table. In the days that I started, you know, again, 54, 55, 56, everyone used to do their own news, their own everything. You know, you'd get up from the control board, you'd go in a little closet, pull the news off the AP, you'd come back and say, well, I'll take this one, this one, this one, and this one. You were fired up and ready to go. Jack, on the other hand, he used to pick up the newspaper as he came over the threshold in the morning. I think he did the news out of the newspaper.
And you know what? A lot of radio stations still do that to this day.
But, of course, he used to do those funny voices, you know, on the air, Dr. Ill and Lady Hortense and the Mighty Gale Players, we called them.
He was a real character, wasn't he?
Yeah. Jack Gale lived on Highway 17, just across the Ashley River Bridge, not very far on the other side of Highway 17. He was speeding in one morning and got stopped by a policeman. The policeman said, where are you going to in such a hurry? And he says, I'm on my way to the station to make a safety spot. And they sat there and laughed about that forever.
It is pretty funny.
They were good days. Truly what I would call the swinging 50s.
A great big TMA thank you to Buddy Charles for his look back at the fabulous 50s on the nifty 1250. In our next hour of the history of TMA, we move ahead to the 60s and continue talking to some of the folks who are a rich part of our station's past. This is John Quincy, and if you'd like to find out more about WTMA's heritage, check out this website, WTMAmemories.com. There you'll find historic recordings, photos, interviews, and more. That's WTMAmemories.com. And keep it here on the Charleston station that continues to make history, as well as report it. 1250 WTMA.